I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we talk with people who have big plans for transforming their cities. Ned Hill is the Vice President of Economic Development at Cleveland State. He's combining the Cleveland area's history, talent, and expertise to create the District of Design. It's a concentrated area of downtown Cleveland to be transformed into the industrial design capital of the U.S. We'll also talk with James Corner and Laura Adams from Shelby Farms Park, one of the largest urban parks in the nation. Located in Memphis, Tennessee, the park is more than five times larger than Central Park. James Corner, with his team at Field Operations, is the winner of the park's design competition. Laura is the deputy director of the Shelby Farms Conservancy, a not-for-profit organization established to plan the future for the park. All this and more coming up after the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Ned Hill is the Vice President of Economic Development at Cleveland State. He's working with the university, the city of Cleveland, and many other organizations to create the Design District of Cleveland. This district will take a section of the city's downtown and fill it with consumer product showrooms, design studios, and the infrastructure to create a Milan of the Midwest and transform Cleveland into the product design capital of the United States. Ned, tell me about Cleveland's Design District.
Well, the Design District is a place. There's 28 blocks. It starts in downtown and travels around a little bit. And in that 28 blocks, we've got about 120 businesses, 1,200 employees that are in the design supply chain. So what we've done is we've taken a small part right in the middle of our theater district, and we've got 100,000 square feet of space that we are turning into design studios, showrooms, customer experience spaces that mixes in with the theaters and the restaurants around it so that we can create a place where a design culture actually exists in the built environment. There are about 60 global consumer products companies in the northern part of the state, and we've got active interest in about 15 of them, five we're negotiating leases with. But that's just the real estate part. We know we have to start by building a place. But at the end of the day, you take that design culture in that place and you drive towards thought leadership and design and how do you manage innovation and how do you manage the design process. If that happens, we make a difference to the balance sheets of the companies, and that means that we have a place that has value and we change the city on the side.
Ned, you have more disdain for fads than anyone I know.
Oh, that's the truth.
You do. So what made you see an opportunity for what could sound like a fad, a design district in Cleveland?
I consider economic development the art of connecting the dots that nobody else sees, and that's what's happened. We've got all the bits and pieces, the nebula of a very competitive industry sitting here, but you needed an ability to pull it together, and this is what we saw. Cleveland Institute of Art sits 4 miles away from the heart of the district. They have arguably the nation's best industrial design program. There are three, four other places that can argue. But just in the Housewares Comp show, they've won 80% of the awards for the past 3 years. Their kids are in huge demand, and the kids say, we want to go to someplace that's got a design culture. So those kids, the talent at the school is the building block. The next piece is we've got the history of Victor Schreckengoss. Victor started what's arguably the oldest design program in the United States at CIA. Victor passed away, unfortunately, last year, and as his stepson said, he lived halfway through the FM radio dial. He's 101 and a half when he died. So we've got the history, we've got the talent, and we've got this great, broad, widely diverse set of consumer products industries, all of whom are now beginning to realize that design is part of their competitive advantage. Now that the dollar has swung, it coupled with production just makes us a potential powerhouse. And it's connecting those dots made the difference. Then, my university, Cleveland State University, it's our neighborhood, and it's our view of economic development that we were able to make a business case as to how this affects the income statements of companies. Fads are ideas that don't connect to the balance sheet. This connects directly to the balance sheet.
Economic development is about connecting the dots that no one else sees. How do you begin to see the dots in a community?
There are a couple ways. The first thing is, I'm an economist. I pay attention to numbers. And we really started seeing just a disproportionate number of industrial designers in this economy. That I didn't understand the business. So we went out and actually just talked to them. And this is where the economic anthropology takes place. We tried about 6 years ago to make this thing happen before Dan Cafaro showed up to direct the industrial design program at CIA. So we had the social and political players there. We had the money players there, but we didn't have legitimacy in the industrial design community. Dan moved into town. He had the exact same idea. After a phone call, we had a room full of people. We were completing each other's sentences, and Dan gave us legitimacy in the design community and with the companies that use design because he's one of the nation's finest strategic designers. So it was Dan and I connecting at the hip. And spending a lot of time. We figured that we have done this presentation and held more than 50 forums on this idea, and each time it gets bigger and new talent shows up. In fact, Carol, I don't know if you know this, but we're starting our own industrial design high school this fall.
Oh, that's exciting.
Absolutely. We've got $900,000 committed. We've partnered with Community College, Kent State University's arts education department's doing the curriculum. We're looking at Dash High School in Miami as part of the model. And, in fact, all the kids are away this week at their first boot camp at the Cleveland Institute of Art. You know, you get a low-income kid, and they go home and tell mom and dad, I want to do art. You know, the next thing they're going to do is give them a dope slap and say, you got to make a living. Well, with the design high school, it's a different modality, great way to teach, especially kids who may, you know, learn differently other than actually find out a lot of really good designers have learning disabilities. Gives them a whole new way to learn. These companies we're talking to want to provide internships for these kids because, you know, the talent of tomorrow is bringing in kind of the diversity of America into their showrooms. So what we're all set to do is start with internships. These kids hit 16 years old, put them to work. And then there are colleges, including Cleveland Institute of Art, including Cleveland State University, that are ready with scholarship money. We're creating a job ladder and a career path. It doesn't get more fun than that.
Why was it important to give this a place and a name? Is it necessary to signal your ambition to make this thing a reality, to have a place and a name?
Absolutely. What both the companies and, more importantly, the students told us is there needs to be a design culture. And, you know, we teasingly say, you know, we want Cleveland to be the Milan of the Midwest. We're tired of being the Milan of the Midwest. And the place has to be there, one, so that you make for fluid labor markets, exchange ideas. What is just terrific is the American Society of Materials, ASM International. They have their global learning center in our neighborhood, and the place makes it possible for two reasons. One is it gives design an identity. Two, we're working with Scott Richardson to mark the buildings and the showroom so people can see it. It's here already, but it's on the second floor. People can't see it, so it's not top of mind. Three, one of the customers of the district is the wholesale buyer. Wholesale buyer can fly into Cleveland. We're kind of turning the merchandise mart inside out. Stay at a hotel that's in the district. We've got a design district concierge under training right now. They can visit multiple companies and the supply chains here. We've got two rapid prototyping facilities within the district, one at Magnet, which is part of the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, one at a community college. So someone can come in, work with a designer, specify the product, the material supply chain is here, specify the materials, prototype the product, and if you can move fast enough, we even have the photographers here to get it ready for your catalog.
Wow, that's impressive. And this is a great example, Ned, of a university-community partnership that, you know, really makes so much sense. But how do you, you know, so many of these things you see really are a real estate proposition. It's all about increasing the value of the real estate. I mean, arts districts, I mean, we've both seen these all over the place, and there's...
Yeah, an arts district is a way to hold the real estate until somebody who has real cash shows up to use the space.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. How do you guard against that? If you were sitting in another city and you weren't who you are, didn't have the knowledge you have, how would you know that this is real instead of let's increase the value of the real estate?
Well, the third partner, which I kind of overlooked, is the Playhouse Square District, which is a community development corporation that runs and manages a large chunk of the theater district. They've just bought a 40,000 square foot building to launch the design district. We've got 100,000 square feet reserved. Owning that building means that we can control the rents, and the leasing plan that just went out last week. They've got some fabulous prices. And all the other surrounding landlords that want access to our pool of tenants have to agree to this lease agreement. And so it really is the control of the price and escalation of the leadership of the real estate that's important. Then the second piece, and we're working with our community foundations about this now, is to ensure it's more than just a real estate play and going for thought leadership. As part of the proposal going to the foundations, and we've got great signals it's going to be funded, is going to be money for speaker series, seminar series, Cleveland State's business school, engineering program, my economic development program, all are lined up to start working with Cleveland Institute of Art to really talk about not only the art of design, but the management of design and the competitive basis of design. And so that helps. The other thing, which is really hard to understand, Carol, but it turns out that Ohio produces industrial designers. We've got, three, four good design programs in the state. Cincinnati's a strong competitor with the Cleveland Institute of Art, but Columbus School of Art has one, Ohio State. And there are lots of people who grew up in Ohio become industrial designers. We have tracked what we call the Ohio Design Diaspora. That diaspora has written back in mass saying, we'll do anything to make this thing happen. All of them are willing to speak here for free. We just have to figure out how to get them here. And if you go through the list of world-class designers, from BMW's lead designer to Motorola's designer, the lead designer of General Motors in Europe, we can go into the furniture industry. We've got to say all of them either were educated in this state or they were born here. And they are just so excited to see this thing happen. They want to build it. There's also a city branding issue. From talking to the students, it's clear that, they're looking at New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco as places that have design cultures that they want to be a part of. The branding part is all of those cities are always going to be known for something other than design, because design's a very small industry within each of those places. Boston's always going to be known for finance, education, and medicine. New York is always going to be known for New York. Chicago, headquarters, trading. I mean, you've got a great design community, one of the best, but it's always going to be a second-tier activity. Cleveland is, we're a good second-tier economy for which this is going to be a distinguishing factor. They kind of like the fact that this is a place where, through their talents and what they do, they're going to help change this place.
How does this differ from a cluster strategy, or is it in fact a cluster strategy?
It's a smart cluster strategy. What we really did was we took a supply chain view of the world and tried to figure out where the value in that supply chain was. And the way in which we connected the dots was look at the reinforcing mechanisms around a cluster. I mean, it says, what's the knowledge that's not written down, that's not codified, that's not out on the web, that creates value for a company and makes a company sticky? And then we try to say, what talent do we have that is in great demand globally and but scarce, but deep here? And it turned out that industrial design passed those screens. So what bioengineering and genetics is to Boston, industrial design is to Cleveland.
If it works, what's at stake for Cleveland?
Oh, just our future, something small. I really can't be glib. People said, gee, what's the economic impact? What's the number of jobs and all this? And we're pretty blunt. So we can't calculate that. Our lead tenant, they got their offer letter on Thursday, and I'm happy to say they're going back and forth with the architects and working like crazy. They're talking 15,000 square feet. And what this tenant is looking at is design space, marketing space, consumer experience space, and they want flexibility so they can swap out the showrooms 5 times a year. This one company uses between 1,000 and 2,000 hotel rooms a year.
Not bad.
That's not bad. They are global. So what this company has told us is that this one activity in downtown Cleveland could secure the 2 million square feet of production space they have in Northeast Ohio. It's difficult to figure out the multiplier on that one. Our number two company that is ready to line up, they're an Italian-owned company. They make espresso machines. They use 500 hotel rooms a night, international clients. And what they're really interested in is mass customization. They're looking at it and saying they want to move their marketing department downtown. And the more activity they have, and with the dollar falling, Northeast Ohio now becomes a very competitive potential secondary manufacturing spot, an alternative to Italy. All that is the way this thing builds. We can only figure out economic impact when it's a marginal increment, kind of a little bit more of the same. This one's disruptive. So it's hard to figure out what the exact numbers are.
Let me ask you something, Ned. I know that you have been a leader in the state of Ohio attempting to look for new economic opportunities in the face of declining manufacturing, and yet the conditions for manufacturing with cheap dollar
and now high gas prices, high transport prices.
I mean, the paradigm is shifting here. Are we at risk at all, in your opinion, of getting to the point where we knew we had to transition away from manufacturing and now... Oops, wait a minute, opportunities, let's go back to that and yet not do it smarter this time.
Well, I guess, you know, you and I haven't had the manufacturing discussion. I've been working on manufacturing issues since 1998. In fact, we'll be releasing an auto supply chain strategy for the state probably in about 2 weeks. I've been saying that probably in about 2 weeks for 3 months now. Again, we're using the same model we use for the design district, following the supply chains, following tacit knowledge, looking at market share and looking at the strategies of company, and we're coming out with a very, very aggressive automotive supply chain strategy for the state of Ohio, really looking at the shift from the old domestics to the new domestic auto suppliers. Our argument is that very routine, low-wage, low-margin manufacturing is not going to come back here. But with the 70% decline in the dollar, the increase in gas price, we're seeing the old geographies reassert themselves. So as we're dealing with manufacturers in Ohio, auto in particular, but we're also working with the appliance industry with this, big white goods industry, in the airframe supply chain, we're saying the same thing. It's thought leadership. It's providing solutions. It's flexibility. And as we finish the, 70 interviews we did on the auto supply chain, what we found was workplace flexibility was the key. We were actually demonstrate that we were competitive to China before the dollar fell excessively. As soon as the renminbi started to float, Ohio showed up as a productive place, a productive location. What is the tough part now with manufacturing coming back is reorienting the survivors to understand that you got to export and go global. Just don't tend the garden that's at your feet.
You said thought leadership, flexibility.
Yeah, workplace flexibility is critical. Thought leadership and providing solutions, not just parts. You know, as we look at the traditional big three, they still have the mindset of standardizing as much as they can, posting the part up on the web, and going for lowest delivered price. That is not the same model that new domestics work, which really is a production relationship that looks at the full risk-adjusted cost of the part, not delivered to the plant gate, but actually manufactured and assembled inside the product itself. That's a very different accounting, and it really requires partnership with supply chain rather than a Darwinian supply chain.
Where could you go wrong with the design district? What are the pitfalls for cities trying to do something like this?
There are two huge pitfalls. One is, if you just knock off what we're doing as a real estate play, you aren't going to make it. It really is the talent that is the sticky part. The second pitfall that we are currently working with is the free rider problem. The free rider problem is huge. The free rider problem are those companies that want the district to succeed, but they're so jealous about their current set of designers, and they're so jealous of their designs and so untrustworthy of their own competitive strength that they want to remain geographically isolated. But they want the district to survive so that when they lose their designers, they come in and pluck up the talent. One company in particular I can think of, great company. I love the ownership of the company. The product is a terrific product, but their competitive advantage is four designers. They are located 30 miles outside of downtown down a backcountry road. You turn the corner, man, there's these three big buildings sitting there. They want the district to succeed, but they don't want to move any of their design talent downtown for fear that someone's going to poach them. If that's the way you think, you don't really trust markets, and you don't really trust how good you are as a company. So it's getting over that free rider problem and understanding that geography is a way of infusing new talent and keeping you sharp. The companies that are responding understand that. Other thing we found out, this is fascinating, is that if we try doing this going up through the line of business, it's not going to work. The every single company that's here is here because a C-level executive, a chief something or other, CEO, CFO, COO, chief marketing officer, understands that this is a way of executing a value-added strategy and differentiating their product. The C-level executive has to commit to this, or the company is not going to have the guts to invest.
As you try to develop something like the design district or certainly even the auto supply chain that you're looking at, you are a big proponent, Ned, of getting the business climate issues right, particularly the way government responds to business issues. Talk about that a little bit and the role that business climate plays as an overlay for something like the design district.
Sure. Carol, what we find out with all the work we've done in economic development is that if a state or a region doesn't have the fundamentals right, no Fed's going to cure the problem. So we've spent a lot of time in Ohio working with the past administration and the current administration on economic development strategy and on the fundamentals. So one of the background changes to this was about 3 years ago, Ohio just changed its business tax code so that we don't tax capital and we don't tax plant and equipment at the state level. The locals still have real estate property taxes. And we've got a very broad, flat, and low tax basically on in-state sales. It's tough maintaining the discipline not to exempt companies from that, but business should pay some taxes. That has made a huge difference in the inflow of capital investment in the state itself. We've seen it from everywhere from auto supply to biopharma. And in the design area, what we're beginning to see now is companies being, despite the housing slump, are really starting to make those capital investments. We had a quote in the auto supply chain work that was just fascinating. One CEO told us, "The most frightening thing in the world is to invest $500,000 in a machine with $250,000 part with defective help." So the talent side is the part we also have to work on.
If you were advising the man who becomes president in January 2009 on what would make a difference for the economy of Ohio, what would you recommend?
You know, what's going to happen to whoever is president is going to the same thing happen to Clinton. His leading constituent is going to be the bond market. You have to get the fiscal structure of the country back under control again. This has been, with the current president's probably, well, we'll have a horse race as to whether he's worse than Carter or not as an economic president. We have to get those fundamentals right. The other thing that we have to put together is a health care plan that works, not one that's single payer. But we need something so that the risk of paying health care insurance is off the back of business. We've had this conversation before. One of the large barriers to entrepreneurship in this country is the fact that people have to work for their benefits. And we have seen, you know, random health catastrophic disease put companies out of business. So as I'm looking at healthcare, I do think we need universal preventative, but what we also need is universal catastrophic. Leave everything in the middle up to the companies and up to the market.
Ned, if you were beginning at the beginning in another city, one you did not know, and trying to find the magic there, trying to find the dots that no one else is seeing, where would you begin looking?
Well, Carol, that's a great question. I'm really proud of the fact that the group we put together here and the work we've done, we've never come up with the same solution for any two places. So that means that we really aren't the public policy peddlers trundling airport to airport with the exact same solution on our jump drive. You know, one of these things where you pull out the Word document and globally do search and replace, right? The unique attributes of City X, fill in the city here. We don't do that. So what we do is we start with a very rigorous statistical analysis of what the current base is, what the trajectory of the base is, and what's happening to the markets for those sets of products in those detailed industries. Then what we do is we get out and we talk to people because the leading edge is never in the data. It's in what's happening right now. And if someone has transactions-based data, we try to look at that. And then we always put it through the exact same filter and this filter's work and saying what's the value chain relationships and is there a leverage point in the value chain? And then we look and say, is there a tacit technology advantage? This is stuff that's not written down that can create value. And then we look and say, is there something magic in the labor market that's also tacit, not written down, that makes a place sticky for a company? And we're very rigorous with that template, and it seems to work. It's gotten us, you know, in the Columbus metropolitan area, it's got us focused heavily on automotive R&D in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 sector. In Cleveland, it got us focused very heavily on industrial design. Actually, we experimented with this up in Grand Forks and Duluth on these things. And the Grand Forks, what is it but sport airplanes? Different in each place.
Ned, it's always fun to talk with you. I always learn more than one thing. And so,
well, and also, Carol, you are just great when I'm starting to make it up at calling me on it. So this is good.
Only once, Ned, but I'll never live it down.
Remember, 50% of economic development's leadership, Carol.
Anyway, it has made me respect you even more. So, Ned, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Terrific, Carol. Have a good day.
Ned Hill is the Vice President of Economic Development at Cleveland State and a co-founder of the Cleveland Design District. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with James Corner and Laura Adams about Shelby Farms Park, one of the largest urban parks in the nation. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Collette. Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. For the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development, we look to PlanEd's an assistant editor, Nate Berg.
This week, conservationists and timber company officials in Montana struck a deal on the largest land purchase in the history of the United States. 320,000 acres of Montana forest land will be sold to a handful of conservation groups, according to a recent article in the Missoulian. The $510 million deal will prevent the land from being sold for housing development, transferring ownership from the Plum Creek Timber Company to groups like the Trust for Public Lands and the Nature Conservancy. Growing concerns about sprawl in hard-to-reach, fire-prone areas had many in the state advocating for conservation efforts. The buyers say that after the sale, the land will remain as it was, an actively logged forest, but it will no longer face any danger of development. Meanwhile, a new study has revealed some surprising results. Gentrification, it turns out, may not cause lower-income people to move out of changing neighborhoods. A study of more than 15,000 neighborhoods across the U.S. shows that when communities experience an influx of affluent people, the pre-existing low-income non-white residents don't actually leave. These findings by researchers at the University of Colorado at Boulder, the University of Pittsburgh, and Duke University run counter to the common perception of gentrification as an economic wrecking ball for lower-income communities. Research shows that instead of gentrification driving prices up and residents out, it more commonly creates middle-class neighborhoods to which more minorities move. And when comparing the number of people moving out of neighborhoods, there was little noticeable difference between gentrifying areas and other neighborhoods. And finally, a recent zoning meeting in New York turned from a policy discussion to a screaming match. Some attendees were protesting that the city needed to provide translators for the meeting, which was about zoning changes that could push high-rise developers into an area occupied primarily by Latin Americans and Asian Americans. According to the New York Times, the protesters wanted Spanish and Chinese translators at the meeting so that the people being affected by the possible zone change would be able to understand what was happening to their neighborhood. And with increasing diversity in many American cities, the question of whether public meetings should be translated is one that may start popping up more and more. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. At nearly 4,500 acres, Shelby Farms Park is almost five times larger than New York City's Central Park, and it's one of the largest urban parks in the U.S. James Corner is the award-winning landscape architect whose design for the park won the competition to create the master plan for the park. Laura Adams is the deputy director for the Shelby Farms Park Conservancy, a not-for-profit organization responsible for planning the future of the park. Laura, Shelby Farms has a really interesting history. Give me the short version.
Shelby Farms was a penal farm, and it was owned by Shelby County government. And at that time, all of the lakes that are there today, 22 lakes were dug to support farm animals. And then in the late 1970s, the land was declared surplus. And once it was declared surplus, people started coming in and using those lakes and everything else recreationally. And we had about a 30-year tug of war over Shelby Farms and what would happen there. There were proposals for mass development there that would have included office buildings and housing developments. And finally, around, I guess, around the mid-1970s, the park had its first master plan by Garrett Ekbo. But the master plan was never implemented because at that time the political will and the money was not available to do so. So starting again in the early 2000s, one of our great bank leaders, CEOs, who was Ron Terry, had a concept for a conservancy for Shelby Farms that would take the park private and it would be run by a nonprofit. That plan failed, and we have resurrected it, and now we have a 34-member nonprofit board of directors who manages 3,300 acres of 4,500-acre Shelby Farms Park, and we are developing a comprehensive master plan for the park.
Why now? Why, and why choose an internationally recognized firm like Field Operation to redesign the park? I mean, it sounds like your ambitions are very big.
Our ambitions are to create what can be and will be the greatest 21st century park in America. And the reason for this is because cities really have to take an inventory of their assets. And there aren't any other cities that I know of that have a 4,500-acre space geographically located near the center of the city that can be leveraged to its full potential like Shelby Farms. So we really wanted to engage the best talent so we would end up with the best product.
James, when a group of citizens from Memphis, Tennessee come to you and say, we've got 4,500 acres and we want the best 21st century park you can deliver, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's fantastic because a lot of public projects we deal with have complicated bureaucracies. They're typically city and state agencies and so on. And here we have really a group of private citizens who are committed to leadership and philanthropy, and they want to make a difference in Memphis. So the sort of decision-making process and how we get from A to B to C looks really smooth here compared to the situation in many other cities.
Ah, but you're just at the beginning. let me ask you this, though. James, what does this know? I mean, is there such a thing as a 21st century park, or is that just, you know, language that the marketers use? I mean, when someone says 21st century park to you, does that conjure up something that is different than parks that Olmsted built?
The 18th and 19th century parks were outgrowths from the old hunting parks and the royal parks, and were improvements to a degree of an existing landscape with new plantings and earthwork and water features, but mostly for passive use, mostly for strolling and viewing the scenery, if you will. Parks today in the 20th, or in the last century, which wasn't so long ago, the 20th century, much more recreationally oriented for strolling, cycling, going to the beach, and this sort of thing. In the 21st century, parks have much more complicated agendas than they have had in the past. There's so many different constituents. It's no longer only about scenery and scenic improvement. There's also huge environmental imperatives, historical and cultural stories to be told. You know, a park now in the 20th century is a huge panoply of complex, competing desires and demands. And what's good at Shelby Park is because it is so big, at nearly, 4,500 acres is nearly 8 square miles. So it's big. And when you have land of that size, it's a lot easier to be able to accommodate all of these different groups, and to create something, therefore, that a very diverse constituency can relate to as a unified territory, if you will.
The park is overwhelming to me. It always has been. It's so big it seems foreboding for me to go in it. And, of course, many people feel differently, and thank goodness they do. But I'm curious, how do you tackle 4,500 acres? How do you make it feel at once unified and yet serve these, as you say, competing interests and yet still feel like a place with a theme or an identity?
Well, there is a thing in landscape history called prospect refuge. Places of prospect are typically very big landscapes with great vistas. You can see for a long way. You have a position of prospect. You have a scenic overlook, if you will. You can survey and see the land. Contrasted to that are spaces of refuge, which are very small, intimate spaces, hollows and depressions and woodlands, and spaces where you can feel that you're away from it all in a much more intimate way. One of the strategies at Shelby Farms is to really play on this prospect refuge thing, so that big vistas, the big vantage points, the places of prospect are the things that allow you to comprehend the whole and comprehend something of the big scale of the site. But it also has, you know, a multitude of places of refuge, places where you can get away from it all, where you can feel enclosed, where you can feel that you've escaped. A huge strategy here is to retain this scale contrast between very, very big vistas and much smaller, more intimate settings where people can feel that they've escaped.
Will that take much remaking of the landscape itself?
It's not a huge transformation in terms of millions of cubic yards of new earth and a total makeover. To the contrary, the site can be managed and cultivated and improved with a series of discrete moves over time. We do have some bigger ambitions, though. We do propose a huge lake in the center of the site that will be three times the size of the existing lake. And this will be a significant earthwork and will be a significant feature. And it's really the iconic, wow feature at the center of the site that would be a huge draw for the people of Memphis. And secondly, the planting of a million new trees, which will enhance the vegetative cover on the site, improve the ecological and environmental quality of the site, and also help to buffer out some of the views of adjacent roads and adjacent buildings so that the park will feel even bigger. So there are some big moves, but a lot of things can also be built on existing assets.
How do you use productively what LARA will bring, which the citizen council, the citizen advice? I mean, as a designer, how do you think about weaving in the public's opinions and diverse opinions, conflicting opinions, with your own vision of what the park's potential is?
Well, I always feel a huge amount of responsibility for these projects to the people who are both instigating the effort, in other words, the leadership of the Conservancy, who are staking their reputation and their careers, really, on the advancement of the park. And secondly, the everyday user, the people who come to the park, who have been coming to the park already for many, many years to use it on an almost daily basis, as well as, you know, potential new users in the future.
And yet you've managed with that philosophy to win international awards for your design of Freshkills Park on Staten Island. You designed the High Line in Lower Manhattan, which I understand has just recently broken ground. How does the opportunity at Shelby Farms compare with those projects?
Well, it's different. It's a very different site. It's a very different context. It's a very different landscape physically. It's a different program. So in many ways, it's different. In other ways, it's similar. It's about making a distinctive and unique place that will be unlike any other place on the planet. There'll only be one High Line. There'll only be one Shelby Farms. And that's part of the trick, to avoid what I call the parkification of places, because the tendency with public parks is to make them as bland as possible. And you make them bland because that way you get your sports fields and your paths and your plantings and everything safe. But it's also bland, and one park in Memphis might look like another one in Toronto, which might look like another one in Houston. And the trick is to try to create very distinctive places that are very unique and very special to their own context and to their own history and to their own geomorphology, their own geography, if you will. And that's what we hope to do at Shelby, to sort of capitalize on its agricultural heritage, on the sorts of uses that take place there, these sort of big country exertion uses. We think that's interesting and important in a culture that tends to overeat and tends to not get out enough, that to be able to have a resource at Shelby Farms where you can come and do large-scale exertion activities is going to be a big deal. And that's something very special and a little bit different from the typical approach towards parks.
Part of the appeal or even sale of parks today is the prospect of rising land values and increased development surrounding them. But that seems difficult to make happen at Shelby Farms. As you look at the neighborhoods and the development surrounding Shelby Farms, what do you expect to happen in those neighborhoods as Shelby Farms is developed according to your vision?
Well, I think there will be growth. There's also a larger sense of connectivity. It's not only the boundaries of Shelby Farms Park itself. There's a proposal to take an old CSX rail line, which is 13 miles long and connects into the center of Memphis, as a pedestrian and bicycle link. The Wolf River goes through the site, and the Wolf 2 is a 22-mile-long greenway. So, you know, the park reaches out, if you will, and there are these lines of connection and lines of access. I think the largest effect is on Memphis itself as a sort of city. It's not just about Shelby County, it's about Memphis. And what we're seeing increasingly are cities around the country, around the world, resorting to parks to help to bring a sense of unique and special and distinctive identity to their city and to their region. That sort of thing is crucial today for cities that are competing for residents, for businesses, for something that's often called the creative economy. The economy of bringing creative people to work and to live, to make your city more competitive to another city, isn't only in its transportation systems and its tax structure, etc. It's also in its open space amenities. And Shelby Park is going to be one of those things that really brings a new sense of specialness to Memphis.
I wanted to ask you about the two linear connections that you've already mentioned, the abandoned CSX line, 13 miles, and the Wolf River. Do you see those two connectors as central to what you will design for Shelby Farms? In other words, what role do you expect those to play in your design? And do you expect what you do to jumpstart additional development on both of those linear projects?
Well, I mean, I think the Wolf River Greenway benefits from the development at Shelby Farms Park, and the plans for the CSX line will likely be expedited also because of this, and everything benefits. You know, what I like about when parks reach out is that they have a much more extensive network of connectivity and accessibility than if they're more of the traditional model of something that's framed and fenced and gated, so that people may find themselves stumbling into Shelby Farms Park one day if they're using the Wolf River Greenway or the CSX line. You know, they all feed on one another, and it's a great thing when you can have connectivity and open space.
Laura, you've been working in the park for so long, and you've worked so hard to try to bring it to this point and get all the citizens together with the transportation planners, with the philanthropists, with the government officials. You've done a really remarkable job to this point. After bringing James on, I'm curious if your view of the park and its potential has changed in any way.
Well, I always knew that we had something that was special and unique, but bringing James on and with his broader, really global perspective has really made me realize we're really in the right place at the right time and that we need to think as big as possible.
What does that mean to you?
That means that having a great park is important, but having a great park that really makes a city great is more important.
I love your thought. How do you see that manifested through Shelby Farms to Shelby County?
Well, I mean, you know, you can think of parks in other cities. You can't think of New York without thinking of Central Park or Piedmont Park in Atlanta or Forest Park in St. Louis. I think that Memphis has an opportunity, really, through the park and its connections, to leverage in the largest way. When I opened my paper yesterday or the day before, it was this great article about a doctor who lives in Germantown. And he and his wife, he's African-American, he and his wife have three children. And in the course of 1 month, they went to three graduations in three different cities. And the article went on to say that none of his children are moving back to Memphis. So Shelby Farms and projects like this, I think, offer an opportunity for us to create a magnet, a livable place and a magnet, so that we can attract new talent to Memphis, but we can also encourage our existing talent to choose Memphis.
How do you expect a park to make that happen, Laura?
I think that people first choose where they're going to live before they choose where they're going to work. And while it's a big expectation, I think it's borne out by our reality. Just on our own board of directors, we have top executives from our major corporations, Federal Express, International Paper, and others. And they are on our board partially because they have a hard time attracting a talent to Memphis. And their top executives are already out at the park on our mountain bike trails every Saturday, meeting and going through the park. But they leverage it very strongly as they're out around the world trying to recruit the top talent to their companies. And our Chamber of Commerce does too. They have an initiative called Fast Forward, Memphis Fast Forward. That's an initiative to increase jobs, top-paying jobs in Memphis, to make Memphis a more livable city. And they are actually one of the funders of our master plan, Fast Forward is, our chamber, because they recognize that in their arsenal of things that they have to sell Memphis, that Shelby Farms is already one of the key weapons that they have.
Well, I look forward to seeing what you make out of this specific place, Shelby Farms. James, Laura, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
James Corner is the landscape architect with the firm Field Operations. His design will be the master plan for creating Shelby Farms Park. Laura Adams is the deputy director of Shelby Farms Park, the not-for-profit organization responsible for planning the future of the park. There are times when Walker Smith loses his temper, but this week our City Views commentator shares his insights on how to keep your cool in even the most frustrating situations.
There are certain situations I assiduously avoid. Every time I allow myself to go there, I get into trouble. For example, I no longer call the 800 customer service number for any airline. I know from decades of experience that I will get upset about some irrational rule or some snappy agent, and the call will end with a flurry of nasty remarks and no resolution of my problem. So I just call my travel agent and let her help me. I no longer travel certain roads in Atlanta at certain times of day. I know from decades of experience that I will get frustrated with the traffic and start to drive aggressively. This upsets everyone else and takes too many chances behind the wheel. So I just avoid these roads when I know they'll be bumper to bumper. When I realize I'm going to be stuck in a line or dealing with a rule-bound customer service agent, I now make it a point to go over in my mind everything that could possibly happen. That way, nothing catches me by surprise, and I've already rehearsed being calm. I've also prepared myself for not being disappointed. I have found that this really works. I can't always avoid frustrating situations, but I can prepare myself to be under control. In his book, Civility, Yale law professor Stephen Carter reminds us that anger and rudeness are a form of selfishness that is inappropriate to civil community life. As he notes, civility involves sacrifices of us. It requires that we show our respect, love, and appreciation for others around us by not doing something that we would rather do, some self-indulgence that we would prefer, because we get satisfaction from blowing off steam and being intemperate with others. But Carter points out that civility is more than just holding our tongue. It is also giving of our time and effort and money in order to build a greater good in which we can all share. He mentions attending a PTA meeting when we'd rather be watching TV, or fighting for our country when we'd rather be home safe. Or, I would add, doing something to make the day better for those who are at that moment making our day worse. A civil existence is something we all seek. Carter writes that civility is essential to us if we are, as he says, to make bearable the many indignities and frictions of everyday life. In other words, life is inherently difficult, so let's treat one another with respect and make life better for everyone, ourselves included. This isn't easy. For me, it takes constant reminders and mental rehearsals. It takes awareness and discipline. All of us can be more civil, no matter how we're treated by others. We're just being lazy when we respond to rudeness and disrespect tit for tat. We can turn it around instead of adding to the accelerating spiral of incivility. All it takes is a little practice. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. We've had some great comments from listeners on our program, Driven to the Brink. Heather from Coral Gables, Florida, wrote in to say, we'd forgotten one way of getting around a city, the Segway. She says the police in her cities use them instead of bikes, and they really enjoy them. Heather, we've got Segways in Chicago, too, and we see police in Millennium Park using them, along with visitors who just want to test them out. We've also heard from Jack in Chicago, who writes in to brag that his walk score is 97. We want to hear from you. Tell us your story ideas, your favorite methods of transit, or even just tell us your walk score. You can contact us through our website. Just head over to smartcityradio.com and click the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. You can also email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our newlywed producer and engineer, just back from Las Vegas and a big wedding there. I'm Carol Coletta.